Hey, you guys, this is Carolyn from Homesteading Family. And before we get started on today's podcast, I just wanted to tell you about a really great flash sale that we're having right now. Now, some of you guys may have heard that our magazine, the In the Homestead Kitchen magazine, is going to print. Yes, it's going to an actual print magazine in January of 25. And we're getting really excited about it right now. There is a special offer on it and a chance for you to lock in this great low price before it turns into a print magazine and the prices have to go up. So make sure you jump over right now to homesteadingfamily.com/podcast-magazine and grab this really special offer. You get the first magazine for only $1. So you'll get to check it out and make sure you absolutely love it. This magazine features new recipes every month and inspiration and tricks from the homestead, but it really looks at taking the fresh produce that you're getting either from your farmer's market or from your own garden and how to eat it fresh, how to use it in more creative ways, but also how to preserve it in all different ways. So it's got a lot of great ideas for the preservation of different foods. So again, go to homesteadingfamily.com/podcast-magazine.
Hey, you guys, this is Josh.
And Carolyn.
With Homesteading Family, and welcome to this week's episode of the Pantry Chat, Food for Thought.
This week, we are answering.
Hey, we should do that sometime. We should ask questions.
We have a lot of questions.
We do have a lot of questions. As do you guys, which is why we're answering your questions.
On gardening, specifically.
Hopefully, we've got some good answers for you. It is the spring rush. We're a little scattered. That might come out today.
We're a little tired. We feel like we're running kind of fast around here because everything's happening. You were just saying, it looks like the cow might be in labor, which means we have a milk cow kind of.
With 125 chickens arriving this morning.
Yeah, and goats imminently ready to kid any day.
Stuff that has to get into the garden.
Everything needs to get into the garden.
It is spring. Spring has sprung, and we are no longer in that waiting for it to spring. We are now in the spring rush, which is all good and exciting, but a little overwhelming at moments.
One of the challenges with it, I think, this year, though, is that the weather hasn't entirely decided that it's spring.
The weather has not played ball. It has been, April has been all over the place. Not enough rain. Negative temperatures at times, which is highly abnormal for April.
Well, not negative temperatures.
Early April?
Freezing temperatures, but not negative. We weren't below zero Fahrenheit.
No. It got cold. It got cold for April. It's gotten cold this winter. We've had baby fruit trees that I think have died because it's been so cold.
I looked up yesterday and it was like a blizzard outside. All of a sudden, I don't know where it came from, but the snow was coming down so hard. I think it was the hardest snow I'd seen all winter.
Yeah, for about 5 minutes. It was deep winter.
And then it was sunny. And then it's just kind of, so I guess it's springy.
Spring in the mountains.
It's a little challenging to get out there and want to be out there to do all the work that needs to be done.
This feels a little more Marchish in weather to me. Anyways, we're carrying on. We're going to have a little fun. Might be a little scattered. But
I'm sorry. I have to add to it. On top of all that, what time of year for the coffee maker to break? You notice we're mugless.
We're mugless.
If you're watching on video, we are officially mugless this morning. There's no coffee sitting in front of us. And that is because the coffee maker
broke. It is bad. It is
that.
A bad thing. The coffee maker
So if you
breaks.
Catch a little like pessimism in our voice, in our tone, it's the coffee. It's the lack of the coffee.
Well, I almost think we've covered what's going on around here.
That's what we've been doing.
Anything else you want to add to that before we
move on? I think we covered it pretty well, but we have been getting a lot out in the garden, both the terrace garden, the cottage garden, so beyond both, and the main crop garden. It's all starting to fill up right now, whether it's snowing or not. We're putting plants in.
Since we're ranting, can somebody explain to me why the grass everywhere we don't want it is already 8 inches tall, and we're still waiting for it to get tall enough in the pasture?
This is like homestead realism in the spring.
Yeah. I know. It looks like we have it all together most of the time, and we've got it pretty together. But, you know, like anybody else, we panic and run and
there are moments stress. We feel a little run over.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so on to happy thoughts.
Yeah, I think we have a...
We covered the chit-chat pretty well. Is what
oh, it's exciting. Yeah, yeah. It is spring. There's lots of happy thoughts. We've got babies on the ground and more babies coming.
Tulips. We have tulips
everywhere. Oh, the drive-in. The drive-in is beautiful.
Goodness. So gorgeous. Yeah. It's really fun. I love
flowers.
So
is the green. Spring green. It's like spring green.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It is vibrant.
Yeah.
It's like somebody turned up that saturation on the TV or something, color saturation. It is bright everywhere, which is exciting.
Yeah.
So, yeah, good. It's a lot of good stuff. Hey, yeah, we have a brand new sponsor this week that I am really excited about because this is another company that we have been using for years. I was trying to count back in my head, and I think we have been using Pleasant Hill Grain for... I come up with 13 years.
Now, I better tell everybody what Pleasant Hill Grain is.
So Pleasant Hill Grain, you can get all sorts of appliances for your kitchen, including grain mills,
which is the predominant thing, right, that they're known for.
I mean, only because of their name, because at this point, I've also gotten every mixer I have purchased in the last decade from them. I've gotten things like the electric tortilla press, which totally changed the way we do tortillas. It made it actually reasonable to
do. How many mixers have you bought in the last decade?
Two.
Okay. I was concerned there might be a mixer fetish going on here when you talk about how many mixers I've bought in the last decade.
No, a Bosch. And I burn through KitchenAid. So every so often I break down.
I don't think KitchenAids hold up. I know they're pretty and popular.
But the Bosch has, though.
I mean, yeah, the Bosch is amazing.
I bought one a decade ago, and we make bread. We probably use that thing four or five times a week to make, like, something. But oftentimes it's huge batches of dough for bread. And that thing is just amazing. It is a workhorse. But, you know, we've used them. I've been going to them for a really long time. You can also get things like grain, actually, from them.
Oh.
Although it's really the appliances that they're really well known for. And the amazing thing is they have the most phenomenal customer service. If you have a problem, you call and you actually talk to a real person. And they've got a great warranty. Anything you don't like, you've got a 30-day really solid return period. So if you're looking for any small appliances, again, they've got a huge range of different things. Make sure you go check out Pleasant Hill Grain. We love them, and we're really excited that they've chosen to sponsor the Pantry Chat. So it's pretty cool.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Thank you, Pleasant Hill.
Yeah.
And you guys think Pleasant Hill because they're helping keep this thing rolling.
Let them know that you came over because you heard about them here. They will really appreciate that.
Absolutely. All right. Well, couple of non-gardening questions, because we always just do a couple of
questions of the day.
So okay. Non-gardening here. This one is for you from Peter477. Regarding the video, a whole year's worth of lard in one day.
Cool.
It's a lot of lard for our house.
It is a lot of lard.
Why is rendered lard not a botulism risk? The jars seal, even though they aren't canned, so there's somewhat of an oxygen-free environment present. Correct?
Yes, that is correct. However, botulism needs multiple things in order to be able to survive. One, it needs actual botulism to be alive and get into the jar, right? So it needs a botulism spore. It needs at least 14% moisture, and it needs an oxygen-free environment in order for it to become toxic.
Mm.
Okay? When you render your lard, one, lard is not an item that is highly associated. Fat is not an item that is highly associated with botulism. Botulism spores come from your soil. So that's why you have concerns for things like carrots, right? You need to peel your carrots or your potatoes before you can them to get as much of that soil off of them as possible so you have the lowest bacterial load. Fat, on the other hand, has not been sitting in your soil, hopefully, before you work with it. So you should be pretty good. The maybe a little more to the point is the amount of time spent cooking prior to actually putting them into jars. So that means you are going to kill off any botulism spores that did somehow end up in your lard because it's randomly floating around in the sky, possibly. Now, that's already a pretty small risk right there. Then when you put that fat that has been strained, cooked for a long time, strained, into a jar and cap it down, there's no moisture in it because that's the whole point of rendering your lard, is to get rid of the moisture. And so it does not have a moisture-rich environment. I know lard, we kind of think of something like fat as moisture because it's liquid. It can be liquid at times, right? But it does not have a water content. If it did, your lard would mold very quickly and it would not be good. If you have a concern about that, though, if that's still, like, I know some of us, we're still getting used to some of these things and what's safe and what's not, you can always stick your lard in a freezer, right in the jar, just stick it in the freezer, and, you know, there really isn't, unless you have moisture sitting in your lard, there isn't a way that it's going to have or support botulism because it has to have that moisture. So the fat's just not enough. But if, you know, if you want an extra step, stick it in the freezer.
So, excuse me.
There we go.
Cool. I'm just gonna move on to garden.
Let's go to garden.
Here,
great.
We've got plenty
we
to
have
do.
A lot to do. Okay.
Yep.
Ooh, hoop house questions.
You pick
right
one.
Off the top.
All right.
So you're kind of the hoop house expert. I'm gonna ask a few.
I don't know about that.
Okay. Does planting a hoop garden using cattle panels reduce the amount of plants you can plant in the garden versus just using trellises or string trellises? That's kind of the heart of the question there.
Yeah. No, not necessarily. It all just depends on what you want to do. You're planting vertically still, which is great because it leaves more space available on the ground to use for other things. The hoop house is just bringing them in over you as opposed to straight up on a, what were you talking about? Or string trellises or some sort of just straight vertical trellis. So, you know, it kind of becomes a matter of what you want. The nice thing about the hoop house is that for something like beans, it leans in and brings them over you. It makes it very easy for harvesting. Otherwise, those trellises are, can be up and high. It makes it very easy to harvest. It also creates some shade so you can grow things like your cabbages inside there, other things that are a little more shade tolerant. So it creates a little micro environment. You may or may not like that or need that, but it provides those opportunities. But it doesn't reduce your growing space.
Well, and I think also remembering that you can still grow in front of the plants in your on your cattle panel. So, you know, if your plants that you are growing up your cattle panel and trellising are on the edges right against that panel, you still have bed space available, you know, in the middle
well,
of that.
Well, that's the point, right?
So that you have that extra bed space.
Right, you're not taking up any more ground. And good point, it would be shown that way in the video. The beans are out against the panel.
Right.
So we've still got 30 inches of bed inside that row of beans to plant in.
Which goes right to the next question, which are what crops do you grow under your tunnel trellis?
We're usually growing brassicas because we're taking advantage of the natural shade and they don't like the heat, the mid-heat of our summer. And so it's often cabbages.
Kohlrabi
we've done.
We're still figuring out some broccoli,
Brussels sprouts. Mm-hmm. So that's usually what we're doing.
We usually do celery under there also. We've been doing celery for the last, I guess, some years we've done celery.
We didn't last year.
Okay.
Yeah, no, we've gone out. Yeah, we've actually gone out. We have done celery before, but we've actually gone out into the row, which is making me think about our garden plan and where the celery is.
Where is the celery?
Because I don't recall it now that you say that. But we better get celery started. I don't think we have.
It is started. Oh, it's all nice and big like
wow,
this.
Wow, she is.
Yeah.
Very cool.
We are ready to plant those out in just another week or two.
Yeah, the other thing, you could do some lettuces.
Yeah.
You could do some other, because they don't like the heat of the summer either, so that could help you extend your lettuce. Now, if you're very limited in space and you're in a cold climate and you really need the sun, then that might not be so advantageous for you. You might want a trellis on the north side of a garden bed and so that you've got more direct sun. So, you know, you want to make sure it's the right setup for you.
Okay, let's see. What veggies? Okay, we just answered that one. What are your favorite things to grow inside the tunnel greenhouse? Inside the tunnel greenhouse. So this is when you have taken that hoop house, put plastic over it.
Ah, and we made a DIY kind of greenhouse.
Yeah.
Well, for us, it is tomatoes, cucumbers, peppers, all those heat-loving things that would like our soil a little bit warmer. And we can extend the warmth of the day because our nights still get pretty cold even in the middle of summer. So those are the things that work for us in our environment.
Melons, too.
Melons too, that we've moved melons to the actual greenhouse. We have a small greenhouse and the melons really like it there. Yeah. Plus we can trellis them, and it gets a little hotter in that greenhouse than it does in the hoop house.
Do you have to hand water everything in the hoop house, or does it still get enough water from the ground?
No, it depends. If it is a open, if it's just like the bean tunnel, then we can just use our regular watering system, which we do a low profile overhead water, but it distributes the drops smaller, the Dan Jan system. If it is hooped, then we are using a drip line for that. We don't want too much moisture in there. And we don't want to, I don't mind, a lot of people don't want to get water on the tomatoes in our environment. That's not a problem if they're open air. They dry out fast enough,
right.
Unlike the South and in more moist places. However, you put it in that hoop house, then we don't want to be watering the tomato plants. We want to just get it right into the soil.
Exactly.
You want me to throw one at you?
Okay, well, no, I'll keep throwing these at you for the hoop house.
Okay.
Do you take the plastic off for warm weather plants like beans?
So we don't put it on for beans, right? The beans, we do not put the plastic on. They don't need it. For us, we get warm enough. There could be some places where I could see you'd want to run the beans inside, but we do not need to do that. We do it with the tomatoes. We're still experimenting with what works best for us. We have some challenges with tomatoes. They just don't like our environment. And so we've left it on. We've put it on in the spring, taken it off in the summer, put it back in the fall when it gets cold again. And we just have some struggles with tomatoes here in the north, and we're still working out what exactly works best.
How do the hoop houses with plastic fare in the windy parts of the country?
Well, they need to be fastened down well. We definitely have learned that, where we have not fastened it down well enough, and it became a parachute, and it literally pulled up our cattle panels one year partway. It didn't, thankfully, float off into the forest up in the trees, but so you do have to be cognizant of that and anchor everything to the ground. Hoop houses have these tracks. I do not know what to call them. They're 4 to 6 feet in long, and that you can tuck the plastic in, and then they have a little springy wire that goes in that holds the plastic down, so you screw that track down to a board in the ground or a piece of metal, and then that holds it in there. And one of those standard systems for hoop houses works great, and we get not extremely windy. We get our wind in August sometimes, mm-hmm. But that works well enough.
Okay, and somebody here referring to the non-covered hoop house saying it's beautiful, which it really is when you have green beans growing up all over it. It is gorgeous.
It is.
But how do you handle crop rotation? I'm very curious about this when I see people who have stationary tunnels for growing certain things.
Mm-hmm. So we have two tunnels, okay? And things like beans are nitrogen fixers, right? And so they actually can add nitrogen to the soil. Lower demand. And so we have four rows. We have two tunnels with four rows. That gives us four different things. And so we can rotate those and move those around each year on, so nothing ever comes back till the fourth year. And that's what we do. Besides, we do other things like, planting a multitude of different things. We leave the roots in the ground. A lot of stuff that helps build soil. Ideally, if your soil is diverse enough, you should be able to move away from stressing about crop rotation as much, but that's kind of a different subject. We're kind of halfway there, so we do still rotate, and it works with two of those.
Okay, so I think that's all the hoop house questions. We're moving on to seedlings and transplants.
You know lots of that, so I'll give some of that to you.
All right.
Could you plant out your early germinated tomato starts in the green stalk, and then the green stalk is the vertical planter, for those of you that may not be aware, check those out. And then plant out in the garden from there after the last frost date and put new starts in the green stalk.
Mm. So you're essentially asking about planting up, but using the green stalk as kind of your next size planter up, potting up. So you could do that. I mean, it's definitely something that you could do. The one thing that you have kind of going against you is that, unlike regular just the next size up transplant pots, starter pots, the green stalk's a little harder to access to go then get in and get everything out. Well, it's not as easy. So you could do it. I don't know that there would be a huge amount of benefit over the idea of just transplanting or potting up your transplants into the next size up pot and then getting them straight out into the garden.
Another semi-minor issue with that is when you're in pots, your roots are limited, and so that when you transplant, you don't overly disturb the roots. There's always a little bit of disturbance, and that's fine, but I could see in the green stock where those roots really spread out. And then you're creating a little more shock for that plant when you take it out, as opposed to just potting up.
Yeah.
How many plants do we start per year?
Oh my goodness gracious.
A lot. I mean, we just planted out how many hundreds of onions? That's just onions?
480 onions. Yeah.
I mean, there's certainly a lot right there.
And then we just planted out about as many leeks that went out. I mean, broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, and Brussels sprouts all had 75.
Well, and if you're talking like, we're not just talking indoor starts. This is just like how many plants do we start from seed. So you're
1,000 something.
Between 1,000 and 1,500. Yeah. I bet you're pushing 1,500. Right. Yeah.
That would be my guess.
Yep. So. All right, this is a carrot one.
Okay.
I read your article on growing carrots. I've started some cucumber seeds, basil seeds, bell peppers, and cilantro seeds in our basement with a grow light. I used a plastic takeout containers with clear lid so that I could create a terrarium with perfect moisture and humidity. Sounds like a fun setup. Can I also start carrots this way?
Carrots really don't like to be transplanted. Mm-mm. I would not do that. I know that there's some attraction there because you can keep that moisture just right, which is kind of the hard part about the carrots.
Mm-hmm.
But if you just put them straight out in the garden and you just put them a little deeper than normal and pay a little bit more attention. Some people, if they're in a really dry climate, will take something like a small board and put it right over just to help, like, it almost acts as a temporary mulch to keep the carrots really moist. You really only need to do that if you're in an extremely dry, probably windy area.
Yeah.
But aside from that, just put them a little deeper, the seed a little deeper, and they're going to do just fine.
Yeah.
So.
Very cool. Like it. I can answer that one.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So I will ask it. Companion planting. I've been trying to decide on the best book to purchase for a thorough explanation of companion planting and an extensive list of different plants and their companions / enemies. Would you know of such a book to which you could point me?
There's a lot of different books out there. The one that I can reference that is a great starter book would be Brian Lowles. He's a friend of ours from Next Level Gardening.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know the exact name of it, but it's Brian. Look up Brian Lowell Companion Planting, and you will find his book. That's a great go-to. There are tons of books out there. They all seem to have great information in one spot. I think all of us are looking for so much information. It is a hard one to get exactly what you want on because it's not a perfect science. It's not just as defined as everybody would like it. And there's a lot of room to work. But that would be my go-to recommendation to get started with.
Yeah. That's a good one.
Yep. This is a good one. Okay. On the cottage garden. I have never grown a cottage garden or an herb garden. So my question is two parts. First, can I put herbs in pots in the cottage garden and then bring them inside in the fall to keep them going over winter? Or is it better just to put them in the ground and then preserve the harvest in the fall?
Okay. Well, you can definitely do either. Some plants do much better with living in a pot and then bringing them inside. I think right off of something like rosemary, something where there's really a good benefit of having a fresh, you know, for your cooking specifically, you want that fresh. Fresh rosemary has a whole different punch to it than dried rosemary. So for something like that, you can definitely do that. Now, I'm not speaking from experience because I kill things in pots. So I have tried bringing rosemary inside multiple times, and I have killed it every single winter. We're just a little bit too cold for it to survive outside, even with heavy mulch and things like that. So, but people do, and people do it really successfully. You just do need to keep up with the watering. Plants need water. Yeah. That's kind of a basic thing that I can't seem to get into my head when it comes to indoor plants. So you'll probably do better than me on that.
So much for proximity.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes, you know, being too close
you
to something.
You can be just hard to see when it's too close in front of you.
Plants with deep tap roots are usually not best suited for a pot and for coming inside. So I immediately am thinking elecampane, echinacea, different plants like that. They want to die back in the winter anyways, so those are best just put in the ground.
And they're fine. They do great. We're zone four, and they do wonderful.
So you just preserve those in the fall if you need them for medicinal uses. But when it comes to the culinary, that's where you really want to think about being able to get them inside and keeping them in pots. And quite a few of those do really well. Oregano is another one that can do well. Thyme, not so much. It's not crazy about being inside, but people do make it work. Of course, basil, you can keep going all winter inside, which is great because if you have any sort of cold, you're not going to have that outside. And of course, the flavor of dried basil is just significantly different. So grab it, either keep it in pots or just dig it up from the ground in the fall and stick it in a pot and bring it inside. It's a great way to go.
Very cool.
Yeah, good.
Right.
Okay, compost. All right, this is my set of questions to ask you. I can only get wood chips from our power company. Would that count as a brown or a green?
Generally, wood chips would be a brown. That is a carbon-heavy material. Now, a little caveat. If they are chipping a whole lot of live green material in with it, it's going to have nitrogen in it, and so you just might adjust your ratios a little bit. It's kind of an imperfect system there. But as a general rule, wood chips are solidly in the brown category.
So does it matter if the trees are alive when they chip them versus dead, or does
yes.
it really matter the like leaf content?
No, it is alive or dead, and this is the case for anything. This is where people get confused. If something is cut live, it's green and live, grass, tree leaves, plants. If it's cut live, even if it die, it's going to die and sits, you don't use it right away, it is a green because the nitrogen and everything is in it when it's been killed. Okay. If it's cut dead, like say grain, straw, different things like that, leaves that have fallen on the ground,
okay,
they have died and fallen on the ground, that is a
dead
brown.
Dead standing trees would be
dead standing trees would be
yes.
another.
Okay.
When you get into wood, like a full tree, that's where it's a little more complex because if you cut the tree live, the leaves and everything are green material, mm-hmm. nitrogen material. But the bulk of that mass is high carbon, even though it was cut live in a tree.
Okay.
So it's still predominantly carbon without those leaves.
Okay. So you know. It's kind of a gray area that you need to...
Well, it is, and a little bit. And like Paul Gauci and when he talks wood chips, he's actually... And I just had this conversation with Epic Times about this method. And what his wood chips are when it comes to the garden, not like mulching the orchard, which is big wood chips, it is whole trees that have a lot of leaf matter in it that have been then chipped up and composted because it will compost naturally.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a little bit more of a blended product.
Okay.
But usually wood chips, we're talking about, you know, nice sized wood chips that are predominantly carbon, therefore they're brown.
For anyone who doesn't know, Paul Gauci is the man that teaches the
Back to Eden gardening
method. So, you know, if you followed Back to Eden gardening at all, that's Paul Gauci, and that's what we're referring to.
Yeah.
Okay. If using sawdust, again, we're talking about compost, mm-hmm. if using sawdust, is pine tree dust okay to use?
Yeah, so that gets a little complicated. Let me give you a little theory, okay? When we're talking about decomposition, you want surface area. The smaller particle there is, the more surface area there is, and so a lot of times the better your decomposition is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Sawdust kind of starts to go the other way. It's so small and it sticks together, there's not a lot of room for oxygen, and you want a good oxygen environment in composting. And so I haven't composted with sawdust. However, I would say that if that's the resource you have, I would try to figure out how to use it, which would be to just make sure it's mixed in well with other things so it doesn't cake, because if it cakes and gets real clumpy, you're not going to get oxygen and moisture through it well, which means you're not going to get decomposition well. So, you know, use it with caution, sort of, but I certainly, if like you've got a bulk of it and that's what you have, I would want to figure that out, and I would try to. You just, you're going to have to play with the ratios and mix it up well. That's what I would do.
Okay. We have a blood orange tree, and I made some orange juice this week and even froze some. Are orange peels after squeezing good for compost, or is it too much acid for the compost?
Oh, I wouldn't be worried about the acid in moderation. It sounds to me like you're not like taking a big giant pile of orange peels and trying to build a compost out of it. You know, that could be a problem if it's not in good ratio. What you're doing here, it sounds like it's going to go into your food bucket. Your food waste from the kitchen is generally considered a green. I have no problem with those. The only thing I would want to think about is, are those oranges organic? What were they sprayed with that they're not? I'd want to ask those questions. But in moderation, as far as like using kitchen scraps as a green material in your compost, I'd have no problem with it.
What do you do when you have a lot of rainy days? Do you cover your compost pile?
I do, yeah. Don't like to a whole lot. If you can compost under a roof, if you're in a very wet area, that helps. If you're going to cover it and you have that much water, you don't want it getting washed away and leached out, try to put some sticks or branches or bricks or something on the pile and then put the tarp on top of it so that there's still air movement. Composting is an aerobic process and we don't want to limit oxygen. So just try to keep that tarp. You don't have to be perfect. Don't stress. Don't panic. Just try to throw some things on that pile that hold the tarp off in places and it allows a little air circulation.
Great. Let's see. We use a firewood processor for our wood. Could we use the sawdust from it, or would the bar oil from the saw have a negative impact?
How pure do you want to be? This kind of comes down to personal choice. We have contaminants everywhere. If you followed along, we're dealing with the glyphosate and a few things we're working to figure out. And we probably have the same issue from cutting trees and certain things at a certain amount. So, you know, you got to kind of make your own choice. From a purist point of view, yeah, it's not pure, it's not clean, and so it's in the system, and we don't really want those things in our system. From a, like, making things doable and getting this done, I think I was talking to David the Good not too long ago, if you're familiar with the Survival Gardener. He's a great guy to check out, but we were having this conversation and people get hung up on being so purist that they don't even get a garden in the ground.
Right.
Or they don't make compost. I don't want to prohibit you from doing that. We can't make our world perfect. It's contaminated, unfortunately. We can do a lot to mitigate it. So you've got to make a decision on, you know, to me, the way I would think about it is, what is it in the ratio? I don't really want it there, but I've got a resource. Mm-hmm. It's usable. And in minor ratios, it's not going to harm anything as far as like stunt growth or anything like that. It's just is kind of in the system, and it's not great in higher ratios, which we all have to watch, right? So you just got to think that through, but don't let imperfect get in the way of you accomplishing something valuable. I think that's the big point, and then you've got to make your own decision from there.
Oh, that's a good thought. We've got a couple of people here who are looking at this double planting of...
I want to address that.
Oh, okay. We'll come back to that.
Okay.
Double hatching of cicadas that are coming out this year. So if for any of you guys who are not familiar with this issue, cicadas hatch in cycles. Mm-hmm. Some are in 13-year batches, some are in 17-year batches. Those are the two that we're dealing with right now. It just happens to be a very special year where we're getting the 13-year cycle lining up with the 17-year cycle.
Some people are. We are not. We don't have this problem in North Idaho.
Right.
This is a question somebody has in Missouri where they are.
So that means, like, they're saying, like, billions of cicadas out, which are, the concern is that it's going to kind of strip the bare ground, the ground bare. There we go. That's the lack of coffee right there. Strip the ground bare of things as these cicadas come out and they start eating things. So we have one person asking about how do they protect their garden, and another person asking about how do they protect their orchard and their newly planted orchard in this moment.
I would get insect netting.
Yeah.
It's going to be a little bit of an investment, but especially for the trees, right? I mean, yeah, I don't know if this can actually, you know, be bad enough that it would kill the trees, but it sounds like it. So, you know, you can get insect cloth. It's lightweight. You can drape it over the trees. It's labor, you know, take some labor. You can
so
do
does
that.
Replanting your trees.
Yeah, right. So definitely the trees in the garden. And so I would prioritize if I had to pick, like I can only buy so much insect cloth, but I would protect the orchard first, be, you know, my strategy. But you can also do the same with your garden plants, you know, and it's like, you know, how far, it's matter of resources, right? You know, and that's where it can get tough is you know, you can only afford to buy so much cloth, but the more you can cover things, the better you're going to be.
Yeah, definitely. Yep. One resource that we found that we're using this year for covering some of our vulnerable things, not necessarily from the cicadas, but from other pests that we have around here, is NeverSync Tools.
NeverSync Tools. We're not an affiliate, but we're liking some of their products. They are a little pricey, but as you will hear us say at times, good tools are worth the money and they will last a long time instead of buying a cheap tool over and over again. However, their netting system actually isn't that expensive. Some of their tools are a little pricier. They're very well made, but they've got a great great netting system for insect cloth and frost cloth. You can get that kind of anywhere, though their prices were pretty good from what I saw. Mm-hmm. But their hoop and wire system of setting it up is fantastic. Very, very nice system. So that's a great way to go. You can also go to Johnny Seeds. You can get some things on Amazon. Mm-hmm. There's a few places.
Well, and if you're just planning on doing this for 1 year just to protect from the cicadas, you could probably go with the cheaper stuff. And the good thing to know is that depending on the crop that you're growing, you can just lay the insect netting directly on the cloth, especially for something like the cicadas. You're not so worried about them like laying all their seeds inside, you know, right through the netting and then it hatching on the inside in one season. So you can, for things like broccoli, Brussels sprouts, you know,
especially once it's up. Yeah. When it's little, it's
a little weak.
But here's a cost saving strategy. Don't worry about buying the frames, buy the insect cloth and take branches, sticks, and put them in the ground. You might need to put a little, you know, piece of cardboard or something on the top so it doesn't poke through your insect cloth. But literally it's not gonna look perfect, but that part won't cost you any money. You can put your money into the insect cloth and, you know, just get creative on holding it up for plants that are younger and a little more delicate. Once they get bigger, then you can just lay it on them.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Okay, so one last one here on nut trees. What kind of nut trees are you growing? We have considered starting some, but in zone 5, there don't seem to be any that we would want to put the effort into.
Very cool. Good question. And these folks are from the Bitterroot Valley, which is not too extremely far from us, so we can definitely relate to your environment. And I can't tell you the varieties. We are just starting to plant nut trees, and we have some ordered. And we have some filberts. Some
Hazelnuts.
Filberts that are getting ready to go in the ground. And then we're waiting on some chestnuts and walnuts. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that you can get special varieties down to zone 4 on all of these, which is what we have. And we have realized, even though we're rated as a 6A, though we're finding we hit temperatures of zone 4 this year. Hence why I think we've lost some fruit trees that we planted last spring. I think we're a few more than we were even thinking walking around out there. It's a hard winter. So we're now planning for zone 4. And I was down in Coeur d'Alene, got a huge nursery there, and very pleasantly surprised to see that they have some newer varieties. And again, I can't tell you what they are. I don't remember. There's multiple names, but that have been bred for these zones and are proven. So you just got to go look around there in that environment and know that you can find zone 5, zone 4 varieties of walnuts, chestnuts, hazelnuts. Those are the ones we're focusing on. We might play with some pecans because there are some hardy varieties.
Pecans.
People are experimenting with them. But that is definitely an experiment. I don't know.
At least for our area.
For our area, right.
There are also hardy almonds. So you can get almonds, I think, down to zone five. So take a look into that because that's another one that could be really exciting.
But we can speak solidly to the three because they're here. They're all around us. Those three are here around us. They've been here for decades, trees that we know of and that we've even had on property that we used to lease. So you should be able to do a variety of those three. Just check their zone rating for the specific variety.
Exactly. All right, you guys. Well, been great.
Cool.
Hanging
fun.
Out with you.
Yeah, fun talking shop, talking garden shop this morning.
That's a fun one, huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, we'll see you guys real soon. Take
Bye.
Care. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Pantry Chat, Food for Thought. If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, rate, and review.
To view the show notes and any other resources mentioned on this episode, you can learn more at homesteadingfamily.com/podcast.
We'll see you soon.
Goodbye.